This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting ready to celebrate birthday number 100 for Colonel Robert Thacker this week by listening to some of his memories from an amazing career in aviation. Colonel Thacker will celebrate that birthday Wednesday in San Clemente, California, where he is the Pied Piper of the radio-controlled model airplane community. In December 1941, he was a young bomber pilot who'd been ordered to fly a B-17 from California's Bay Area to Honolulu. So you took off about 10 o'clock on Saturday night, December 6th, having no idea, no indication of the chaos that was about to unfold.
Nice and smooth. We were about 10,000 all the way. And about an hour out, I started playing with some nav stuff we had. The radio station stayed on all night at Honolulu for us.
I'm just wondering, I'm putting two and two together here. You're about 23 years old. You've got a wife you just said goodbye to. You're flying a plane that you didn't have much time in with a crew that really had no experience, and you're in the night over nothing but ocean all night. Were you at all intimidated by any of that?
Well, we had been up all night for two nights, no sleep. You're young, and you think you can have anything and do anything. So we really weren't concerned. And all of a sudden, here's this big hole in the clouds. I look straight down, Diamond Head. My navigator had flew 2,500 miles and wasn't off 1 mile by shooting three star fixes all night long. Hobdy, great guy, great navigator. So I let down through the hole, flying along. My radio operator had been there before, and he said, there's Doris Duke's home, we're blah, 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 blah. And I saw these scratches in the sky, and I said, what are those? And he said, that's volcanic action. And there's the Royal Hawaiian, and I said, blah, 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 on the horn. No answer from the tower, no answer from me. This is 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know when the attack started. When? 8 o'clock. So I said, hell, I can see. I said, where is Hickam? He said, you see that big white tower there? That's Hickam, and that's the Pearl Harbor. So I said, what's that great big column of black smoke that just went up? He said, they're burning off the cane fields. Well, that was the Arizona going up. And I said, blah, blah, blah. No one said, come up here and give me a new frequency. I can't get anybody. So, I can see the runway. I can see that big black smoke and see which way the wind is blowing. I'll land this thing because we're out of fuel. We're exhausted. We've been up all night, two nights in a row. So I cracked about half flaps and dropped the gear and started over Ford Island. All of a sudden, the tower came on and said, number Air Force 432, you're number two to land, land north to south. We're under attack by Japanese aircraft. And exactly like that, bang, 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 bang all over the place. The Navy was shooting at me. Well, I was right over Ford Island, and everything was on fire, and anything that was airborne that morning, you know, was what? It was the Jap. Yep. And I've been criticized by calling the Jap, but in those days, you used the word Jap. Now it's Japanese, which is fine with me. But I said, my God, I'm going to get out of here. So I dropped the throttles, broke out of traffic to the right, landed crosswind, there were three zeros jumped me, and he shot the right gear out. I ground looped on the end of the runway and took a look around, and I said, I think we better just redirect here. All I needed was a tire and bombs and fuel, and I could go. And I started towards the flight line, and I said, no, I think this is a mistake. Let's go between Hickam and the commercial airdrop. In those days, it was nothing but a big swamp. So we went over to the swamps, and that's the best idea I ever had, because right then, these 13 in a nice V level Japanese bombers came over Hickam, and they just wiped out the flight line, killed a couple of friends of mine on the flight line. And if we'd have been over there, we wouldn't be here talking to you.
Whew. I can't imagine the amount of things that go through your mind in a situation like that when you know that your friends are dying, you don't know what's going to happen to you. How did you respond to the chaos?
Everything went out of those barracks. Everything went out of those hangars. There were motorcycles. There were people. There were engines. Everything was on fire. They wiped out. They did a beautiful job with it. And 13 biddies, I think they were, at about 8,000. And they didn't miss. They really wiped out that flight line. And where are you going to go? What are you going to do? How can you help? How can you protect? First thing you do is protect your crew, which we let that out. And a little sort of side story. I took the crew down to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel on Wednesday for lunch. It was all free. The Japs were going to take the islands. There's no question about it. We had no foxholes. We had no nothing. It's an unbelievable story. And the Japanese did such a perfect operation. Mass, surprise, all of the great elements of war, and they did it beautifully. There's no question about that. They sank every boat in that harbor. There were 3 feet of Dunker fuel on fire in Pearl Harbor. They sank every boat in the harbor. They sank the floating dock, and they sank the boat in the floating dock. Quite an operation.
And I know as someone with the military background that you have, you can appreciate the success of their operation, but I'm sure emotionally for you, being an American, wearing that uniform, and seeing that devastation had to have some kind of impact on you. What did it do to you in terms of your focus and desire to do anything?
You asked me where I grew up, and I said I grew up in the Air Force. That grew you up real quick. Real quick. But I think my attitude is just a little bit different because the military was going to be my career. I made a judgment at that time. And the military is like any other, it's like General Motors or any other big corporation. And it was my job. It was my job. And I was lucky to survive. I owe this lovely home to surviving 31 years in the Air Force. So my attitude is a little bit different than the great guys I was with, really, because most of them were draftees, actually, and I was a volunteer in 1937. So the situation is a little bit different.
How long did you stay there on Oahu before you started going elsewhere?
We started out doing 800-mile Y searches every fourth day. Then along in about February, we went on over to Australia and Port Moresby, New Guinea. And I flew 48 missions out of Port Moresby. Got a little few side stories of my tour in against the Japanese. And then I sniffled my way after a year over there where the big guns were. And that was in England. And I flew a tour in England, which is rather unique.
Yeah, to have flown particularly that number of bombing missions, both in the Pacific and in Europe. And now, when you get to that high number of a bombing count, a lot of guys would have been back home already. Why were you out there so long? Is it you wanted to be, or because they kept you there?
Well, I guess they kind of decided that after a year of operation that they would send our unit home, and I was sent home, and I started training crews, and I decided that training crews was not my deal, and I wanted to get ahead. And in the military, you go where the greatest noise is. And the greatest noise was in Europe because Germany was the number one guy and the Japanese was the number two. So I sniveled my way and flew a B-17 tour out of England. And it was the smartest decision I ever made.
Why was that?
Because I got myself promoted.
Yeah, that shows up in the pocketbook, too. Well, you said there are some side stories about all those missions out of Port Moresby. Entertain us with a couple if you have time. I'm sure you never got shot at or anything.
Well, this is kind of a funny story on me. During the Battle of the Coral Sea, my B-17 had some radar antennas on it. We were just on a reconnaissance mission at about 20,000 feet. All of a sudden, my radar operator picked up a return only. That's the radar in those days was very primitive. And he said, "I've got an object up there about 40 miles out. Let's go take a look at it." This is the Coral Sea battle. So I cruised over there, took about a right turn of 5 degrees, and well, we didn't know what was down there, but all of a sudden I started getting anti-aircraft return. So I said, "Well, if they're shooting at me and I'm American B-17, that must be one of the Japanese cruisers." So I told the bombardier to open the bombay door and we'll make a run on them. And I'm carrying 4 1,000-pound bombers. Any one of those bombs would have blown a cruiser in half. He set the bomb site up with intervalometers. You drop 1, 2, 3, 4. Damn, he put 2 short and 2 over. So when I got back to Moresby, 7 Mile, I had a reception. I had a brigadier general and a full colonel. He said, "Lieutenant, you just missed the USS Chicago." In those days, the Navy didn't tell you anything. Here I am, the only reconnaissance airplane airborne in the South Pacific, and I didn't know where the USS Chicago was. I didn't know where any of the Navy was. But that sort of piqued up the little deal, and we got a little bit more information on what the Navy was doing. So, you know.
What did that feel like in that moment to be told that news?
Well, I was happy that we certainly didn't hurt anybody. And God, if we had hit the Chicago, that would have just been terrible. It would have ruined my career, really. It would have been awful. Of course, friendly fire is very common in the military. Very common.
That's a lot of missions, and I know there's a lot of stories, and maybe some of them run together. But give us a sense of what it was like to take those missions, what you would encounter along the way. What were some of the, besides that one, which is incredible, maybe the moments where you felt your crew might actually be in jeopardy?
Quickly, I'll just run through, say, a mission, B-17 bombers in the European theater working out of England. By that time, I was, in all honesty, I was probably the most experienced combat B-17 pilot in the business, period. And I always flew as a lead crew. You're leading the wing, or you're leading the division, or I even led the United States Air Force complete with 2,600 bombers running on Berlin, and you have authority to turn them around. You have authority to do anything. That's big authority. But you get up about midnight, you take special lead crew training, and you get off at first light, and there's a group of 54 B-17s every 2 minutes departing the UK. And that is a big, big thrill. The best mission I think I ever ran, and with the bombardier that I thought was absolutely superb. We ran on Peenemünde. Peenemünde is the Germans' big rocket development place. And my bombardier absolutely destroyed Peenemünde from 25,000 feet. That was a great ride. Just a tremendous, tremendous feeling to be part of that game, part of the profession that you've chosen for your life's work. And I've got some pictures of how my bombardier did that day.
Oh, I'd love to see those. And I'd also like to hear, I mean, I didn't hear you mention anywhere in there anything about flak, anything about enemy fighters, but I'm sure that's not because it didn't happen.
Oh, we had lots of flak and lots of enemy fighters, and you know who they were looking for, don't you? Well, what the German fighters were really looking for were people that lost an engine and thing like that and could not stay in formation. the German pilots were no better or no worse than the American fighter. They always, everybody wants to survive in this business. Survival is very, very necessary. Actually, we defeated everybody by the people at home that produced this massive wealth of offensive material. We're no better fighters than the Germans or the Japanese. We just out-manufactured them, that's all. How can the Japanese, with 70 million people, defeat a country in those years with 130 million people? Who's going to win the war? The guy with 130 million people.
Well, and you speak to the manufacturing, and I would think you have a good perspective on that, because you were in the Air Corps from 1937 when there were very few planes, very few resources, and then you saw it at its height at the end of the war. Can you put that into perspective for us, how great the contrast was from pre-war forces for America to at the end of World War II?
Well, I don't have much of a background, of course, for those kind of questions, but...
You saw it, right? You certainly saw the difference.
I was amazed at the motion pictures that we've been able to maintain by the Navy of the masses of seagoing vessels, merchant marines, many of the days. On my first tour in the Japanese Empire, I was the only airplane offensive for that day in the whole theater because we had no aircraft. You're in Port Moresby, New Guinea, and there's nothing in Port Moresby, New Guinea that looks like a B-17. You have got to manufacture that in Seattle and get it over there with a knowledgeable crew, which is a tremendous, tremendous task. But we did it, and of course we won eventually. But for the first year of operation in the Pacific, the Aussies really thought they were going to be invaded.
And you had some situations where any reasonable analysis would tell us you were likely to be killed. We'll hear about some of that from Colonel Robert Thacker when we come back. He turns 100 this week. Keep him in your prayers and keep it here for the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.